Okay, well, we'll get started. I apologise for the terrible day and the awful weather. This is not what I was promised when I came to Australia 8 months ago. But I'm particularly delighted because of the terrible weather to see so many of you here this evening for the fourth in our 2012 series of Centre for Public Policy public forums, which tonight features two of Victoria and arguably Australia's most distinguished public servants, Mr. Terry Moran and Mr. Yehudi Blatcher, who are here to discuss fit for purpose, how the Australian public services can meet the challenges of the next two decades, five themes for improvement. My name's Helen Sullivan, for those of you who don't know me, and I'm Professor and Director of the Centre for Public Policy here at the University of Melbourne, and I'm chairing tonight's session. As we begin, I would like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people, who are the traditional custodians of the land, and pay respect to the elders both past and present of the Kulin Nation, and extend that respect to any other Indigenous Australians present. Those of you on the CPP mailing list will be familiar with the work of the Centre and our programme of events and activities. To those of you not on the CPP mailing list, the question is, well, why not? Please do join. That way you'll get prior notification of some of our upcoming events. All it takes is an email address, which you can leave with us or register via our website. And at this point, I'd like to mention that our next forum on the 7th of August, when hopefully the weather won't be like this, will feature Tony Nicholson, the Executive Director of the Brotherhood of St. Lawrence. But back to tonight's session and my introduction to our two distinguished guests. Mr. Terry Moran, AC, has had a varied public sector career, working with successive Australian federal and state governments in public policy and public sector management. His early career as a CEO focused on building Australia's education and technical skills capacity. But in 2000, Mr. Moran was appointed Secretary of the Department of Premier and Cabinet in Victoria, where he played a leading role in developing an ambitious national reform agenda, subsequently agreed by all states and the Commonwealth Government. Mr. Moran was Secretary of the Department of the Prime Minister and Cabinet from March 2008 to September 2011, overseeing further development and implementation of this national reform agenda, particularly through social policy. He was also responsible for overseeing work on national security and international policy, environment, industry and economic policy, and coordination of government administration, including cabinet support. He also played a lead role in driving reforms in the Australian public service. In January 2012, Mr. Moran was honoured with the Order of Australia Companion for his eminent service to the community through public sector leadership, including policy development, programme delivery, and effective governance. Unsurprising in one who has challenged existing institutions at state and federal levels, Terry sees the role of a public servant as offering frank and fearless advice, and he was quoted earlier this year as saying that one of the highest virtues of a public servant would be respect for scepticism. Yehudi Blatcher, who will be our respondent this evening, is currently Deputy President of the Institute of Public Administration Australia. Yehudi joined the Victorian Public Service in 1980, and for over a 30-year period, he held a variety of senior positions, both policy and operational, each dealing with major reforms to different aspects of the public sector. He was awarded the Public Service Medal in 2012 for his outstanding service in the instigation, promotion, and implementation of innovative reforms in public administration. An award he acknowledged with what I am growing to appreciate as I get to know Yehudi is with his customary modesty, saying you don't expect these things for working within your profession. He continues his work in part through his relatively new role as a professorial fellow with the Centre for Public Policy here at the University of Melbourne. So you will see that tonight we are in both safe and sage hands. The format for this evening will be the usual format. Terry Moran will speak for 40 minutes or so, outlining his arguments, and then Yehudi will offer a response for about 10 to 15 minutes. We will then open the session up for the audience for questions and discussion. And as usual, we are recording the event because very many people who do take great interest in what the Centre does and do watch our live, well, not live, but our recorded broadcasts now expect us to record these. So I do hope that everybody's okay with that. There will be a post-event reception, as usual, in the auditorium, and we would very much like you to stay and join us for that. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome Mr. Terry Moran to come and address you.
Well, Professor Sullivan, thank you very much for that introduction, and thank you, everybody in the room, for braving a very unpleasant night. I thought I was driving here, but then I found that my daughter knocked off my car, so I had to try and get a taxi as everybody else was trying to do the same thing, but I eventually made it. Over the last 30 years or so, public sector reform has been linked to and very much part of broader economic, social and more recently environmental reforms. Take competition reform or competition policy, for example. It's clearly microeconomic reform in its orientation. It's introduced things like competitive neutrality for many parts of the government system, emphasised competition within newly framed markets. It's led to the breakup and often privatisation of government business enterprises, and it's also spurred a whole lot of new and hopefully useful regulatory arrangements. And the Productivity Commission a few years ago assessed that it had probably added about 2% to GDP growth in Australia. But it's also a very significant public sector reform, and so it's at the nexus between the broader economic and social reform on the one hand and public sector reform on the other. So one could say that what was once a detached, secure, even insulated public service has moved substantially over the last 30 years. Privatisation, I've already mentioned, and not too far away from privatisation has been outsourcing. And so the jobs network, federally, would be an example of that, where once there was the Commonwealth Employment Service. Hopefully people in the room here didn't have to be clients of that organisation too often. It had an opportunity eventually to compete as a public provider, but failed through competition very quickly, and now the delivery of the jobs network is in the hands of either companies or not-for-profit organisations. Other changes have been more emphasis on accountability for performance, and this has been particularly driven through reforms in the budget process and how activities in government are measured. IT has had a huge impact on services delivery and management, in part because it's speeded up and magnified the amount of data that can be accessed and analysed, but also in more recent times it's been a prime vehicle for service delivery itself. In Victoria, and more recently elsewhere, but in Victoria since the late 80s, we've had growing emphasis on the so-called purchaser-provider split, popularised by a couple of Americans who were later picked up by an American vice president as the champions of a particular approach to public sector reform. I've mentioned competition policy. Managers, particularly senior managers in departments and agencies, have been given greater freedom to manage with more discretion over budgets, staff, and in many cases the assets as well. There's been a gradual withering away of old-style concepts of tenure, and there's also been much more emphasis on external recruitment, including at the executive level. And there's a broader policy literacy outside government, so that on many important issues, even if it's not the age that reports it, elsewhere there can be debates between well-informed people with different perspectives on the important issues of our time. And then finally, there have been very major financial reforms within the public sector, which have not quite been as successful as the early enthusiasts for program budgeting had hoped, but nonetheless have had a very big impact on how well public funds are used. So one could say that largely over that period of time, there's been a positive impact from these reforms, but it's also true to say that the public service world is far from perfect. Australia itself has done well out of the broader policy-driven reforms, as well as these public sector reforms. So if you look back, not just to the early 80s, but go further back to the late 60s and mid 70s, we've gone down a path of much greater global economic engagement. We've seen continuing structural change in the economy, and that's not just been in manufacturing, but in other areas as well. So for example, education export is now a very large and important export industry. It barely existed in the early 80s. And by and large, the workforce required in most industries has had to become more highly skilled, whether that be through the offerings of universities or offerings within the vocational education and training sector, and many of the activities people in many sectors undertake are higher value in terms of, and higher complexity in terms of their impact, and hopefully better for the economy and better for the individuals concerned. So we've had economic growth, we've had increasing prosperity, and Australia as an economy has been tested in a series of crises, most recently the global financial crisis, and now, as would be acknowledged by many people, but not all people in our society, we're probably the best performing developed economy, and this is due not just to the success of the resources sector, but it's due to other parts of the economy, indeed parts of the economy that were negligible in their size and impact in the 80s, early 80s, but have since become much more important. And even medical research and what it leads to is part of that, but so too is tourism, education export, and a burgeoning services to the resources sector part of the economy, plus a reconfigured manufacturing centre that's increasingly supporting investment in the resources sector. But there are other success stories as well. So as at the end of March, we've got GDP growth over a 12-month period of 4.3%, which I've just been to Europe for 2 weeks, and from that perspective, that looks astonishing. We've got very low public debt. That looks astonishing. We've got robust economic institutions. That's not as common in the developed world as some might expect. We've got low unemployment, 5.1%. I was in Madrid a bit over a week ago. Total unemployment, 25%. Youth unemployment of 50%. The budget will return to surplus in the year commencing the 1st of July. Business investment is up, and it's not all going into the resources sector. And industrial disputes have continued to trend down, although there are a couple of industry areas where there are the odd exception. And along with all of this, we've had major social policy reforms. Can't go through them all, but obviously health and education are important. And in post-school education, by way of an example, there's been a huge increase in enrolments, participation, completions and so forth. But there have also been quite massive changes to welfare benefits, which have meant that we haven't gone down the same path as many of the European countries, and as a result got into all sorts of trouble more generally with a government sector in the economy that would be much, much greater as a percentage of GDP than it is here in Australia. And in the last few years, we've had a new or another spate of reform. The responses to climate change, which are still controversial, with a market-based mechanism for pricing carbon emissions coming into effect from the 1st of July. We've had the beginning of the rollout of the National Broadband Network, which is not only likely to be a transformative economy, transformative influence within the economy and a source of productivity improvement, but it will have big impacts on areas like health and education, and it's also a test by the Commonwealth Government of a new way of doing really big infrastructure projects where it's all taken outside a traditional departmental structure and in this case put into a company, a private sector organisation with its own specialist board of private sector people and highly capable executives and managers brought in from outside as well. We've had the beginning of another series of reforms on public hospitals agreed with all states and territories in the Commonwealth last year through the Council of Australian Governments. We've had pension increases, although the pensioners don't seem to fully understand that. We're about to embark upon a national disability insurance scheme, which has been worked through already by the Productivity Commission, as they've also looked at how we could reform the struggling aged care sector in Australia. And beneath all of these things, where it comes to domestic policy, you've had a rewriting of the rule book on Commonwealth State financial relations, although I'm not sure Brian is as enthusiastic about it as sometimes I am. So all of these things, and many others that I haven't mentioned, represent a very considerable policy load that's been picked up by parts of the Commonwealth and the state and territory public services, but an even bigger implementation and service delivery load, particularly at the state and territory level and in a few Commonwealth Government departments. But the public remains grumpy and unhappy. And I think it was last week in Crikey, they reported the results of some attitudes research, and one question and the answers to it really struck me. So the question was, do you agree or disagree with this proposition? An active government is necessary to provide services and to protect ordinary Australians from unfair policies and practices on the part of large financial and or industrial groupings. The total agreeing with that statement was 67%. ALP and Greens voters registered 82% agreement, but to my astonishment, LNP voters registered 59%. It's not quite what I would have expected. But that general approach, through surveys done by a variety of people, including at least one survey that's benchmarked against US results done in Australia by Quantum, that result has been there in data that I've seen over the last 15 or 20 years quite consistently. So through all this period of reform, the Australian public was not at one with many other people who wanted to pare back government or dramatically change its role in our society. I'm not making a judgment as to whether we should pare it back or whatever, but I'm simply saying that perhaps true to our colonial past or our convict past, there are still lots of people who are pretty good at admiring what the colonies invented in penal times and what's persisted as a theme through Australian government since then, something that Laura Tingle has written about recently in her essay on Great Expectations. And then you might say, well, if people think that about government, they're probably in favour of big government, but they're not. 44% of people agreed with the proposition that government is too large. So the government wants, rather, people want stuff that government can do, but they want it presumably cheaply done and modestly presented. So that takes me into public sector reform. And since the Coombs Royal Commission report was published in 1976, there have been a number of goes at public service reform in Australia. Coombs himself had been set up by Gough Whitlam at the urging of Peter Walensky, who was then sent off to run the secretariat for the Coombs Royal Commission for a while. And Walensky was sort of the leading edge of insurgent baby boomers in the Commonwealth Public Service. Although he wasn't genuinely a baby boomer himself, he sort of stood for that cause. By that I mean these were the younger people who wanted to knock off the old mandarins and see a surge of younger people coming through into senior positions. And by and large they were successful, and they didn't really need a Royal Commission to achieve it. But nonetheless, Coombs reported in terms of emphasising a public service that was more responsive to government, involved the community more and got out into the community more, and more emphasis on results-based management. But having been started by Whitlam, Coombs reported to Fraser, and Fraser had made a point politically of stressing that he was different to Whitlam and was very much the traditionalist in terms of how the public service should operate. And it's one of the many things that I'm very fond of in terms of Malcolm Fraser's view of life. So Coombs was a long narrative. I think it was about 5 volumes, although many of the volumes were consultancy reports written by academics and others. But although it was a long narrative, an intricate narrative, some would say it was low impact. So the impact for the length wasn't quite as you would have expected. In 1980, there was a review of Commonwealth functions, which led to some trimming at the Commonwealth level. There was a new Public Service Reform Act in 1984, which came out of an initiative taken by John Dawkins as Finance Minister in the first Hawke government. And indeed, the report on which that was based was written, as if I'm correct in my memory, by Roger Beale, who retired as a Commonwealth Departmental Secretary a few years ago. And one of the things that that Act provided for was an ability to deploy senior leaders within the public service more readily, including, I think, the establishment of the senior executive service concept. In 1987, at the urging of Peter Walensky, the Public Service Board, the Central Personnel Agency, was eliminated, and it was easier to get at secretaries as a result of that. And in 1996, there were further changes which made secretaries employment based on contracts with performance expectations. And then in 1999, there was some fitting of values in and an emphasis on the merit principle and a stronger role for the Public Service Commission. Now, all of this stuff is for most people, and I'm sure that includes most people here tonight, eye-glazingly boring. But the point of it is that all of these reform themes have to do with the internal HR processes of government. And you'd say, well, why is it so? Because there was a parallel stream of reform that emphasised financial management issues, and I think ultimately that parallel stream had more impact and was of more consequence than the traditional public service reform agenda. And I think the principal reason that this was all a bit dull was that it never encouraged the public service to come to terms ultimately with the connection between what the public service did or delivered and citizens. And that was the point that the reform review that I was responsible for, which led to a report called Ahead of the Game, that was what it was trying to say. It was trying to say, well, all this other stuff is important and we're doing useful things, but at the end of the day, citizens are number one, and that indeed was the first of four themes in the report, Ahead of the Game. There were a few other things in it, but I won't go through it in detail, but one important issue from my point of view is that it defined the roles of departmental secretaries, and one of them was put forward as being stewardship. Stewardship as individuals in respect of their own departments as public service institutions, and stewardship collectively as a group of secretaries for the quality and capacity of the public service as a whole. And I can report that this was debated quite a lot amongst the Commonwealth departmental secretaries and strongly supported as a concept. They perhaps were looking back to Barmier days, I'm not sure, but they all willingly embraced that, and the consequences of it, which included a further strengthening of the role of the Public Service Commission, and having put money in when the government then took money out from that reform effort just before the last election. After the election, all the secretaries got together and said, don't worry, we'll find the money ourselves in our departments and give it to the Public Service Commission so that with one exception, the Commission can get on with the reforms, and so it's proved to be the case. But in any event, Ahead of the Game still had that strong emphasis on the internal HR issues within the public service, and you can see why that's so, because so much reform was needed there in order to better equip the public service to either contribute to the policy debates within government about those reforms, which began, depending upon how far you look back, in the mid-70s or the early 80s, and I think those reforms could have been better, but they took the public services a long way down the path of being adept at dealing with that reform challenge. So to think about where the public service is going now, I for my part think that you can't do that unless you have a focus on what the new challenges are for government. And one could have any number of them, and I won't dwell on them for long, but I've got five and I'll just mention those. So firstly, there's a challenge for government in citizen expectations. There's what one could derive from those survey results that I mentioned about what people think about the role of government. There's always still, despite the reforms, a big Commonwealth-state relations component, and there's also an issue about how responsive the public services are to citizens and their needs. The second big challenge is competitiveness in the economy. So we've got the usual issues like tax reform, industrial relations reform. We've got the challenge of accelerated structural adjustment in export-exposed parts of the economy. We've got a decline in relative educational performance, particularly in schooling. where the countries that are improving are those in our region of the world, and we ought to be deeply worried about what the PISA testing is showing about that decline in relative educational performance. And then in the under the competitiveness heading, we've got the inevitable worry all the time about how well we're going, how successful we'll be in a global economy, which in large part, particularly Europe and the United States, is highly stressed at the moment, such that we can't necessarily assume the sorts of global GDP growth and our share of it that was there over the last few years. The third big issue is Australia in its relations with US and China. As has been often said, our strategic relationship, that is our defence and foreign policy relationship, is with the United States, but increasingly our economic interests are tied to China, and there's a lot of truth in that, but then it steps down to a whole lot of challenging issues. For instance, what will be the future source of foreign direct investment into Australia, and what expectations will come with that foreign direct investment when it comes in here? How will the markets in which we participate, which are now largely Asian markets in terms of our trade, emerge over time? And how will this growing ambivalence between the US and China and its effect on Australia play out in the big non-strategic, that is non-defence or foreign policy related challenges of climate change and food security, which I think there's still strong expert opinion to support the contention that they'll be very big issues into the future. The fourth big challenge is around domestic services, the unrequited expectations of citizens for more in health, more in education, more in infrastructure, and the disgrace of the unresolved issues about Indigenous Australians, particularly in remote Australia, despite vast amounts of money being poured into communities, and at least since the late 70s, making things worse rather than better. And it's in this area of domestic services, plus public safety and at the Commonwealth level defence, that most public sector employees are now engaged. So whatever the policy challenges might be, how well those services go has got a lot to do with how well tuned that majority of public servants at a national level, I shouldn't say public servants, public sector employees at a national level and at a state and territory level are going. And the fifth big challenge, as it's been since the Second World War, but it's probably, if anything, getting a bit bigger, and that is coping with the massive diversity in our population. And by that I mean the different backgrounds of people, whether it be national, language, ethnicity, backgrounds, and the associated differences in the skill profiles that people can bring into the economy, and as a result of that, the level of success in economic terms which they can expect. Also, many of these groups have assumptions about government that are different to the assumptions of the, the Anglo-Saxon Irish heritage of the country that's basically been dominant in the way our constitution was formed and how the conventions governing our system of government emerged, particularly at the national level, for over the last century. So on this challenges front, we dodged the post-GFC economic bullet, but there was actually more to it in our case than booming resources, because all those other reforms had added to the diversity and strength of our economy. But I think that the sort of challenges and others that I haven't mentioned mean that complacency shouldn't dominate our thinking into the future. So how does government, in particular the public services, improve to cope with these and other challenges? And I think there are 5 points. Policy linkage, which is really about the relevance of what the public service does, but also is it focusing its efforts on the high priority initiatives which will yield most either for community wellbeing or for GDP growth. Accountability in the sense of can we get maximum impact for what the public services do, as well as tighter lines of responsibility to individuals and groups for achieving that impact. Citizens, improving their satisfaction, but many other things besides. Efficiency, that's that lower cost issue. And then finally, the role of government. Government's got to hold the ring, even if it's not doing everything as it might have done in the past to deliver what the citizens want. So firstly, policy linkage. Well, it's sort of going to be a matter of policy for some time that we face a period of fiscal constraint. At the moment, Commonwealth government revenues are appreciably below the average take as a percentage from GDP of the Commonwealth government over recent years, and that's largely because Commonwealth revenues are down in selected areas. It was thought they would have come back by now, but they haven't. And when they do come back, there will inevitably be a bit of a debate about what's done with the money, tax reform or expenditure, essentially, or paying down debt. But there'll be fiscal constraint apart from that that once-off step up in revenue as we return to the long-term average of Commonwealth revenues as a proportion of GDP. Secondly, goes back to the point I made a moment ago, that the policy priorities for the future ought to be around what will have biggest impact on GDP growth and the general well-being of the community. The Grattan Institute's recently done some work put out under the heading Game Changers. The Productivity Commission has from time to time also done work on the impact on GDP of selected reforms. And the point of all this is that there's a choice to be made. You can't do everything, but if you make the wrong choice, you don't necessarily get the best results. In other words, if you make the wrong choice, there's an opportunity cost in that, which is higher growth than would have been the case if you'd made the right choice, and also perhaps greater community well-being as well. Another part of the policy linkage is the general tendency on governments in response to the community to increase the number of channels for delivering services, often outside government, and how that's going to be handled. And then finally, there's a huge implementation issue that's under this heading, I think, because if you can get better implementation, people will have more confidence in the results that government can deliver, and will do better at living within the resources rather than finding that things run over the original estimates and more money's got to be found. On the accountability issue, I think there are five broad themes, and this is probably the most complicated area in one sense. Despite all the work on accountability over the last 25 or 30 years, it's still the case that it's often opaque as to who is responsible to achieve results, and it's also often opaque as to how you'd measure them, even if you did know who was responsible for them. And there are also often very, very weak consequences for bad or non-delivery of the things that are supposed to be done. So identifying who is accountable to deliver things sounds really simple, and it's been a theme of public service reform for a long time, but in reality, it's much harder than people think, and there's a long way to go to sort that out. Secondly, and this is a bit esoteric, but at the Commonwealth level and at the state level, there are governance differences between departments of state, on the one hand, and agencies on the other. And at the Commonwealth level, as a result of the so-called URIG reforms in the period of John Howard's government, a lot of things were shifted out of agencies into departments, and many of those departments have been made confused policy and delivery conglomerates that are massively underperforming, bloated with staff, and really not doing a particularly good job. It'd be much better if some of their functions were peeled off again, put with agencies that had expert boards, quality leadership, specialist skills within them to get the job done, and is, as part of doing that, a merit approach to selecting the boards rather than just making political appointments would be a good thing to do as well. And a good example of this sort of thing working well would be the National Broadband Network Company, which has indeed got its board members largely through a merit-based process. The Australian Taxation Office, which everybody doesn't particularly love, is nonetheless, by international standards, a highly effective agency, and it is effective for a number of reasons, including that it's not a conventional ministerial department and can basically manage itself so that it gets on with the job. And a third example of getting stuff out of departments would be the state of Victorian public hospitals, which have, over a number of decades, gone further and further into the position of being self-governing institutions, and they're probably the best in Australia, and they would be seen by many people overseas as a perfect example of how to get it right in designing delivery, even though we in Victoria might occasionally fret about the queues at emergency departments. So if you put more stuff out with agencies, that means that departments themselves, departments of state, ministerial departments, have much less involvement in direct service delivery. Support ministers in respect of policy, legislation, budgets, keeping an eye on results, public presentation. But basically the theme for government departments should be, in my view, less is more. They should be smaller, they should be more focused, but they should do what they are left with better than in some cases they do at the moment. The skills needed in departments are therefore likely to be rather different to the skills needed in most of the agencies that I've been talking about. The third issue under accountability is the role of ministers, and in particular the decay in ministerial responsibility. It used to be the case that ministers could be clear about what they're responsible for, but I think most of that's fallen away, and if you're not clear about what you're responsible for, you're actually not responsible for anything. And therefore, you'll notice in the media occasionally there's a bit of fuss about whether people are taking responsibility for things at a ministerial level. But the reality is it's now so confused that in a parliamentary democracy, the key linkage between the executive branch and the parliament, which is the person of the minister, and that person's responsibility to the parliament for their administration of legislation and departments and so forth, has largely broken down. And it's a danger to our parliamentary democracy to leave that unremarked and unattended to. And I think that it's vitally important that we have a broader debate about how to better define what ministers are accountable for in a real sense, and then for them to be held accountable for those things. The fourth theme is Commonwealth-state relations. It's everybody's punching bag, particularly the business communities. The truth is it's not as bad as it seems. The 2008 federal financial relations reforms have improved things a good deal. There's still further work to be done. But the point is that the Commonwealth's got to stay out of some things that are best left for the states to do. And in the social policy area, what the Commonwealth does best is provide benefits or vouchers, regulate activities, sets prices for different sorts of services, and then pays attention to performance through the analysis and publication of data. The Commonwealth is, by and large, hopeless at actually delivering the services, and it's particularly poor at trying to be in touch with local communities and what they're on about. To compensate for that distance, what's emerged in quite a number of departments, about half a dozen at the Commonwealth level, is what I call programmatic confetti. Hundreds of discretionary grants programs which enable little bits of money to be scattered all over the landscape in the hope that people will be grateful for that and see the Commonwealth's good works at the local level. Truth is, it's expensive, the overheads are high, and it doesn't have, usually, a big impact on the quality of service delivery anyway. So there are a whole lot of issues around Commonwealth-state relations, and the states, for their part, have got to go more in the direction of the Victorian model, which stresses self-governing institutions with devolved authority to get things done, an independent assessment of the results delivered and the price to be paid for their services, and wherever possible, a fairly rigorous approach to not only collecting that performance data but publishing it as well. And then the final issue under accountability, and it's the obverse of the coin of ministerial responsibility, is senior officials and the parliament. And I think that particularly agency officials should have more direct accountability to the department, but so too should senior people in departments. Annual reports from agencies, departments and departments should be, frankly, more revealing of what those bodies are doing rather than a PR blurb. And there's even a role, in my view, for a well-behaved and sensible parliamentary committee to have a role in the appointment process for secretaries and some agency heads. So what this means is that there ought to be more lines in from the executive branch to the parliament, so that not everything is focused on the persona of the minister. And if that's the case, you can afford a system that is more precise about what the minister is actually responsible for, rather than assuming a minister is responsible for everything, which is undoubtedly going to end up causing lots of ministers, perhaps after they leave office, to die sooner than would otherwise be the case. Then there's the theme of citizens, and that's really about a citizen-centric approach, and one size doesn't fit all. Quality and responsiveness is expected, and there are a whole lot of things that can be done by how you structure service delivery systems with an emphasis on devolution, measurement of results, accountability for delivery, which I won't go through, it might come up later. But the story is really about going local if you want to make citizens happy, while at the same time harvesting the benefits of the digital environment to do through digital channels much more stuff on a centralised level, but in a way that people can access in their home or workplace. And governments in Australia are in some respects leading the way internationally on the digital delivery of services, but that's not well recognised yet, and there's still a long way to go before a lot of those services are better joined up than they've been in the past. There's then the efficiency theme, and a lot of that falls out of what I've been saying. If you've got clearer roles for ministers, departments, agencies, various jurisdictions, you can save a lot on overheads and you can get things done faster and better. The programmatic confetti thing, which wastes billions of dollars, should be cleaned up. There are a whole lot of things that need to be done about capability in the public service, which would improve both effectiveness and efficiency. And on the policy front, where for 30 years we've been in love with the products of economic analysis as the basis for most but not all of the policy work government does, increasingly economic analysis has got to sit alongside what I'd call strategic analysis and planning, which is a way of getting inside what's going on in the big service delivery systems in a far more professional way than has been the case in most areas up until now. And given that I said before, most public servants at the national level, at the state level, are actually involved in delivery, there are quite a number of ways in which, in a technical sense, the management of that delivery could be improved, but I won't go into that detail. Then there's finally the role of government, and it really comes down to how do you match a fairly inelastic share of GDP being available as revenue for government to elastic expectations on the part of the community. And I think it really will call forth a lot more effort on explaining to the community the choices that are available and finding ways to explain why some things won't be done. And it also means that government's got to content itself with a role that focuses on it being the funder and the orchestrator of a lot of delivery, rather than the entity that has to always own the vehicles of delivery, which was the assumption 50, 100 years ago. And so come back to the themes, the policy link, accountability, citizens, efficiency, the role of government. There are some hard choices to be made about what governments can do, but the right choices mean you get dividends in terms of greater economic growth and greater community well-being. And if you just make the choices on a seat of the pants basis, you're left with luck as to whether you've got the right ones or not. There has to be an emphasis on treating people at the delivery end with much more respect, I think, in terms of standing in the system. Victoria is probably the best case in Australia for getting that right. We need much tighter accountability for people at all levels as to what they're supposed to deliver and what they do deliver. We've got to accept that the community wants more, but it's got to be for less, and therefore we've got to cut out waste, and there's still waste to be cut out. And there has to ultimately be a refreshed understanding between governments and the community about what the way forward is and what can realistically be done by government and what can't. So the sort of things that, and believe it or not, I've probably, under my five themes, I've probably covered about 30 different improvement initiatives that might be taken, and I apologise for that, but I started out with about 50, so I think I was doing pretty well. But it's essentially an emphasis on improvement, not radical transformation. That's been the interesting thing about Australia. Australia hasn't taken radical steps in public service reform, although it did take some radical steps with things like privatisation for the broader public sector. But within the heart of the public sector, you've got the public services, and they've evolved sensibly over time. And in that, we're rather like the UK and the other Westminster tradition governments in the world. I'm an optimist. Having been around for a long time now, I see huge change since the late 70s. I see better results being delivered. I don't think the institutional ethos of the public service has been destroyed. It's still there, well and truly strong. And Australia still manages to attract many fine people to its public services, and many of those fine people stick around and make a major contribution, as they always did want to do, to Australia and its welfare. So they'd be my five themes under the acronym PACER.
As usual, and I've heard many of Terry's speeches, Terry's provided us with a very wide-ranging speech, rich in history and substance. And as I was sort of reflecting on what I might say, I find that there's probably nothing in his speech that I would disagree with. Maybe that's in part because, like Terry, I've been around for a long time, and if you take the sort of broad historical perspective, then there's been a trajectory of significant improvements, both in the quality of public services and the way in which public services operate over the last 20 or 30 years of essentially my professional life. What I want to do then is, rather than reiterate particular points that Terry's made to help you sort of gauge the questions that you might ask, I just want to touch on two or three issues that I think bear a bit more emphasis. The first issue is the issue that underpins the subtext, I guess, of the title of Terry's speech. The subtitle is How Public Services Can Meet the Challenges of the Next Two Decades. And I'd like to suggest that the mix of skills and capabilities that Australian public services have to exhibit over the next two decades depends on the answer to a prior question, and it was touched on in Terry's speech. What are the most appropriate forms of delivery of public services in the country? And over the past three decades, we've seen a continuous move, both Commonwealth and state level, of services to be provided by other agencies other than government directly. Among the states, that trend has been very uneven, but I think it's fair to say that in Victoria, it's been the most pronounced. Corporatisation, privatisation, contracting out to non-government and private providers are all in the mix. And on the assumption that this trend will continue, the key question for public services around Australia is, do they have the skills to manage the varying relationships that are embedded in the different modes of service delivery? And I think it's fair to say that the report card on this is probably mixed. In general, I think we do pretty well. And despite the often unnecessarily polemical tone of Auditor-General's reports, particularly here in Victoria over the past period, in many ways the Auditor-General is quite right in highlighting, a less than optimum set of skills and therefore putting in front of public servants in Victoria a real set of challenges. I think there are issues in the context of program and project design, contract specification, contract management of many projects and programs. And I think if we're thinking about the public service of the future, then the development of those sorts of skills and the various accountabilities that relate to them are very important. Terry made, I think, one very salient point, and that is that we have a system where we have very poor accountability for poor performance. And I think much stronger performance management frameworks that relate that are very specifically performance related are critically important. The second point I'd like to make relates to something that Terry didn't raise, but I think is significantly important in the sort of context in which we have to operate. And that is the issue of the role of media and its impact on government. The imminent changes announced by Fairfax and News Limited are only the latest transformations which are occurring in a variety of media forms. What we're witnessing, I think, in many ways is an almost perfect storm, and the impacts of the new media environments are really lost on government. That is, how to manage that. And let me just suggest that there are sort of three interrelated trends that are occurring. The first, as we all know, is the staggering multiplication of new media forms and channels, all demanding to be filled with content, regardless of the quality of that content. This proliferation is often spoken of as the democratisation of media access. And whilst I think that's welcomed at one level, that trend often pits the blogger against the expert, with news being the so-called debate between the two, often between a debate between evidence and opinion. And this trend has contributed and is also a manifestation of the increasing dominance of a very strong tabloid approach to media content, an emerging domination of the media as entertainment. And this, combined with the increasing tendency of people to get their views through IT-based platforms, which enables one to flick back and forth page to page in an instant, means that it's increasingly difficult to explain complex issues to audiences with short concentration spans and the means to go elsewhere. And the third trend is the decline in the trust and attachment to long-standing important institutions. And Terry raised that in his presentation. And I think though some of the recent polling that we've seen, Terry referred to Crikey, also some reports out of Lowy, I think are very, very disturbing in terms of the declining trust in highly valued institutions like the High Court, like the RBA. And even more so, observations out of the recent Lowy survey, which had only 60% of Australians agreeing that democracy is preferable to any other kind of government. And for people 18 to 25, that was down to 39%. So the combination of these three factors, if they continue, I think is actually quite toxic. What we have is a public which is disengaged, which is cynical of spin, and spin seemingly is seen as anything that governments want to say, with short attention spans, susceptible to quick grabs. The slick three-word presentation, I think, is immensely powerful, which is highly individualistic, without a sense of the importance of the key institutions that we've had in this country. The importance of those institutions are to the very benefits that they receive as citizens. For governments, that means a tendency to populism and the lowest common denominator policies. It means also a reluctance to undertake innovation or to encourage innovation, because innovation, by necessity, means making mistakes. It means that, and when those mistakes are made, you have relentless media scrutiny of those so-called mistakes, which are used to make a judgment on the performance of governments as a whole. And for similar reasons, we're seeing an inertia against reform. And when reforms are undertaken, they become so compromised because the ability of local interests very vocal interests to oppose change, to an extent that many of the so-called reforms are useless, or certainly don't meet their objectives. And I think notwithstanding some of the important concepts underpinning the new carbon arrangements that are coming in, the fact that the carbon arrangements were supposed to send a price signal and be transformative, but in fact the results of what we have is that the price signals will be so blunted because pretty well everybody is going to get something in order to blunt that signal. Similarly, we've seen similar issues in relation to the mining taxes. So what does this mean for public services? More than ever, public services are going to need to provide and Terry made the comment earlier, need to focus on, in a sense, core skills, the provision of frank and fearless advice, but high quality evidence-based advice to executive government. It also means encouraging governments to communicate using ways beyond the press release and the Twitter. In fact, I can't think of anything worse than politicians engaging in 140 characters and thinking that they're communicating on any basis with their constituencies. Let me finish with a couple of comments about Terry himself and his career. He's always had a passion for public administration and policy reform, and we've seen that tonight in all the various roles that he's undertaken during his career. Not only did he talk about reform, but he's also undertaken reform. But always it's been within a sense of the traditions of our system of public administration. Terry is the only person I know who consciously seeks to trace his professional roots back to the Northcote Trevelyan Report of 1853, which set the framework for an apolitical public service in the United Kingdom. In that sense, Terry might be seen as a Burkean reformist, and Terry, I mean that in the nicest possible way.
Oh, that's high praise.
It is high praise. Terry's reformist zeal culminated, as you all know, in the development of what's now called the Moran Report. And that stands in a very strong tradition of Coombs and Walensky. And I think in the same way, it'll be seen to be contributing in future to the reshaping of the profession. It could be in many ways be seen as the third part of the Trinity. But I'll leave it to you to decide who's the Father, who's the Son, and who's the Holy Ghost. Thank you.
Well, Brian Galligan, University of Melbourne. I think it's too good of an opportunity since Terry Moran has come very recently from managing but also mixing with the highest echelons of Australian politics at the Commonwealth level to shift him off, I guess, his turf of public service and public policy to perhaps to reflect a little bit on the political situation, because it seems to me that this must be tied to some extent anyway to this strange sort of, grumpiness, I think you said, of the Australian electorate with the role of government, political expectations and so on. It just seems to me that currently, and particularly I think at the national level, and it's hard with a hung parliament, I know, but we seem to have politicians who excel in overstatement, raising expectations, whether it's going to be a revolution in education or it's going to be the greatest sort of policy since whatever. Most things seem to be, as say opposed to, in the Hawke Keating period, I guess, overstated, and the delivery seems to be then suboptimal. And so that seems to feed in with this sort of sense of disillusionment, I think, because most people, I think, look more to Canberra and you see it more on the national television. And perhaps that's related to your other point of this myriad of sort of Commonwealth small policies that ministers are running around, a bit of money on this and a bit of money on that. And as I mentioned, the High Court decision yesterday has clipped that a little bit by sort of striking down the Howard chaplaincy sort of arrangements. And part of the judges paid attention to the fact that Queensland already had a chaplaincy arrangement in place, but not much money in it, and the Commonwealth comes in with a huge amount of money. So it would have been possible to perhaps put the chaplaincy money through the Queensland government in the first place. But anyway, your comments might be welcome on the broader political.
Well, one has to be careful about the first part of your question, Brian. If you see politics as a marketplace, you get into a way of seeing something of what's happening in Canberra. It's a marketplace that's got a framework that's institutionally quite light, but in the past has been strong on conventional constraints or constraints through conventions which are generally observed. And two things have basically gone wrong in the framing of that market, where you've got competition between two major sides of politics and then another grouping, the Greens, that's a bit on the side. The first thing that's gone wrong is that the conventions have been set aside by one side in the political fray in the interests of a strategy that owes a lot to the playbook from the Republican right in America. I'm not saying that the people in Australia are as out there as the Republican right is, but the delegitimisation of government and government figures, the very direct, sometimes overstated attacks on people, and even the issues that have been chosen for attacks are, to me at least, suggestive of a lot of what's been going on in America for a few years. But as it's a marketplace, there's competition. And so you've got a thrust from one side, and the real issue is what's the other side doing about it? That is, what's the government side doing about it? And I think that in the last couple of years where things have fallen down is that the government hasn't really found the level of sophistication in political communications and behind that political management that would enable it to deal effectively with this strong assault. And it's not as if that's the only government in the world that struggled, because the Obama administration may not even now have got on top of how you deal with these attacks, but at least they've been making for 6 months or so some pretty solid efforts at dealing with what the Republican right can serve up. So the media, which is what Yehudi raised, really is a totally different set of issues in one sense. I think the media is, the print media in particular, is in a struggle for survival, diminishing readership. Probably most people in this room read a newspaper, but you go out there and young professionals don't frankly read newspapers all that much.
Most students don't.
Yeah. And so what the tabloids are doing and what the other newspapers are doing is sort of screeching and screaming in the hope of attracting attention. Because what the newspaper editors know, particularly of the tabloids, is that the nature of the front page on a day-to-day basis makes a big difference to how many papers you sell. If you have a front page that really captures people's attention, you sell a lot more papers, because the tabloids, more than the broadsheets, have been up until now and probably will continue, casual impulse buyers rather than subscriptions. And so the editors have got a strategy of recognising that and trying to spark interest. And it's more apparent perhaps in the Daily Telegraph than the Herald Sun, but it happens in the Herald Sun as well. And it's commercial, it's perfectly understandable, and you shouldn't confuse it with serious political analysis. And you shouldn't go too far in imagining that it's a sign of political bias, because if the government changes, they'll probably still go after whoever happens to be the government of the day in appropriately strong, even lurid terms. So the media is in a stage that'll take it out at some stage, and even Kim Williams's statements in the last day or so anticipate that. I think he put it, they should still be there by 2020, which doesn't seem to me to be a terribly long time. And the readership of even the Herald Sun is declining, as big as it is. So I think that what the national political debate is about is two sets of politicians are passing in the night without effective engagement, and they probably know it, but both sides can't win with that strategy.
My comment about the media was not specifically about print media. I mean, I think the real issue is print media will just take its course. It's just the proliferation of different media outlets and different media forms, and the challenge of filling it with anything that's called and under the heading of content, and it lends itself to tabloidisation, was a horrible word, to becoming tabloid, and any politician that masters the three-word phrase is always going to do very well, and I think you know, the current leader of the opposition has a marvellous ear for that. He comes out of a journalistic background, and it is very, very powerful, particularly in an environment where people don't concentrate and are not particularly interested in what most of the people in the room here would call serious journalism. And so it is, I think, we're seeing a watershed change in the nature of media as the vehicle for communicating into a democratic society, and I don't think any of us understand the implications of it. And certainly it is hugely difficult, and Terry's right, for any government, because anyone who's in government will always be the focus of media attention. So it's a good time to be in opposition if you want to score the points.
Okay. Oh, right, lots of hands now. Okay, well, I'm going to go this way.
Thank you. Terry, Ronnie Beecham from Moonee Valley City Council. Your third tool for dealing with the challenges is about a citizen-centric focus, and one of your opportunities you mentioned was to go local. Yet local government is very rarely ever mentioned when we have discussions about public policy and indeed the public service. We have no constitutional recognition. I'm just wondering whether you can ever see that changing, and perhaps for Yehudi, what do the state governments need to do, or what sort of reforms, further reforms, do they perhaps need to introduce to get local government to the state that, well, the situation they'd be happy to have them constitutionally recognised?
Well, it could change, but it won't change, I think, until there are quite profound reforms in local government. From the perspective of a state government or a national government, you look at local government, and there are plenty of exceptions to this, but basically you don't think that any given local government is necessarily going to be there for a long-term journey about something. So all the big complex areas of services delivery, whether it's health services, environmental services, education services, much less Indigenous issues, all depend upon being able to sustain an effort to deliver something coherently, not only just in the medium term, but in the long term. And local governments, and this is not spoken about very much, but local governments are regarded as here today, gone tomorrow, partners, because there might be an electoral upheaval in a local government, a new council comes in, and they say, oh, we don't want to do that, we want to do something else, and then what had been emerging, perhaps through the work of the CEO or something like that, the CEO of the local government authority in partnership with state governments, disappears. So I think potentially local government could be enormously important, but it hasn't done what the state governments as they are now did in colonial times, and in colonial times it was actually the Queensland colonial government and the Victorian colonial government that picked up on the Northcote Trevelyan report in terms of a professional civil service, and so some have commented by the time of Federation all of that was taken for granted, and it therefore wasn't dealt with much in the debates leading to Federation. And that tradition has persisted at the Commonwealth and state level, not always fabulously well. A certain place to the north of here has had a rough time in the last 10 years or so. But generally speaking, Victoria's done pretty well and other states have done pretty well. But that sense of professional capacity and independence isn't as well established at local government, and therefore it's hard to see how state and national governments will buy local government as an enduring partner for a new focus at the local level on delivery of services with obviously most of the funding coming from another level of government.
Just to add a couple of comments. First of all, I'll answer the question you asked Terry, which was about constitutional recognition. I don't know what Terry's view about it is, but I don't think I would oppose constitutional recognition.
Well,
of local
now
government.
That you've said it, I would oppose it too.
and I think in many ways the very issues that came out of the recent High Court judgment is the reason why I would oppose it. Terry made comment in his presentation about the myriad of programs. I call them rent-seeking programs to curry favour with particular groups. There are thousands of them. I think this is a really poor way of using public money. And in fact, my former life, I had administration responsibility for dozens and dozens of them. And my capacity to reform them met both sectoral interests, opposition and political opposition. More significantly, though, I think that when I think about the concept of citizen-centric government going local, it doesn't necessarily mean local government. I think local government does have a role to play, and good councils are very sensitive to that. But the notion that one implies the other, I think, is just simply incorrect. I think there are a huge range of self-generated well-constituted community organisations. And in a sense, the challenge of citizen-centric government, whether it's a federal, state, local government, is actually to think past the institutions and actually think about the notion of how one designs services from the perspective of the citizen, and then come to a view about who should be involved both in the funding and delivery of those services. And I think that's a far more productive way about thinking about how one develops a concept of citizen-centric government than the more traditional intergovernment relations format that we often talk of.
Could I add one more point? In the total population, there might be 10% plus of the population, conceivably as high as 20%, but probably not, who are people with complex needs. And so from government's point of view, their needs can't be met from just one channel of service. They need multiple channels of service. So take people with acute mental health difficulties, for example. They need clinical assistance, but they're probably also going to need assistance with housing, employment, and a variety of other things. And even in the clinical space, there are lots of different clinical services that have to form a pattern that's appropriate to the individual. Now, that's not a good example to raise in local government, but conceivably, somewhere in the system, we need people who can be paid to effectively manage towards a favourable outcome a variety of different services around the needs of that small part of the population. Well, it's not small, really. 10 or 20% of people is a lot, but those people with complex needs. Government departments aren't succeeding in doing it all that well, and it would be worth having a discussion about how it might be done by a local entity at the local level, but there's scepticism professionally about the professional capacity of local government to do that well and reliably over time.
And I think if I can just say, before I come to the next question, local government is one of the things that comes up in almost every forum that we have, which is leading me to conclude that we should be having a forum on local government. So we will do that in the future. Okay.
Dennis O'Neill. I'm a private sector consultant with a footprint in both infrastructure and resources. Terry, thank you very much for a very lucid offering tonight of directions in which Australian public services need to head. I'd just like to take you up, though, on the point of evolutionary change versus revolutionary and pick up the point about accountability to suggest that I'm seeing in the space in which I work, and I think it's probably inferred in some of the things that Yehudi said in response, that there's a need for a sense of commerciality within our public services because of the rapid change in the service delivery models that have emerged in the last 10 to 15 years. And what I'm seeing is a profound lack of commerciality, which in turn then feeds into a rapidly escalating cost structure on the part of the service to be delivered or the party delivering the service. And we've seen recently information offered by one of the major resource companies that in the last 6 years, Australia has moved from being best in class amongst the OECD countries, i.e. lowest cost regime or jurisdiction for development of large projects, both infrastructure and resources, to worst in class. And not a small part of that, I mean, some of it obviously is exchange rate and some of it is lack of skilled people and so on, but not a small part of it is the regulatory systems that we now have in place and the complexity between the Commonwealth and the states to ensure that those projects are assessed properly from both an environmental and a social perspective, and the delays in getting the approvals through. I sense that there's a lack of accountability and commerciality on the regulation and approval side, which needs to be somehow uplifted. We need to reskill or upskill the parties involved on the government side in undertaking those tasks. Can you offer some comments on just how we can go about that in a revolutionary way, not an evolutionary way, because we're in a competitive world?
Yeah. Well, firstly, those stats that you mentioned are probably those associated with the World Competitiveness Index, which is compiled in large part on the basis of surveys of business executives. And the latest stuff I saw had about 125 business respondents in Australia, so it's not really a big sample. And most of the cost, even in the reporting of it, was, as you acknowledged, attributable to the effect on costs within the domestic economy of the substantial shift in the terms of trade and the exchange rate. Although there's a skilled labour supply problem, particularly in the resources sector, which is leading to lots of people working on a fly-in, fly-out basis. But to be honest, the volume of fly-in, fly-out activity is in part due to the fact that the resources companies have given up what used to be an accepted responsibility, which was them investing in local community infrastructure, including housing, to sustain a workforce in a remote location. So, for instance, you can still go to Mount Newman in the resource provinces of Western Australia, and it's a lovely, totally isolated town with families and decent housing and facilities built a long time ago. The resource companies don't do that anymore, and therefore they've created either an expectation that governments will pay for it, or they'll just take the easy option and bring people in, which inflates costs. So the story here is much more complicated than the headline numbers would suggest. However, there's one area of regulation which is a major problem, and that's the environmental regulation, where you've had both the Commonwealth and the states operating under the, I think it's called the EPBC Act, in a way that causes immense delays. And the COAG process has been chewing on this for a couple of years since there was a major review of that act done by Alan Hawke. And he found that the Commonwealth should stop being stupid and should reach an agreement with the states and territories where if they met certain standards in their regulatory activities, the Commonwealth wouldn't then seek to duplicate it. And when I was in Canberra, I was a strong supporter of that, but oddly, it didn't seem to register much at the national political level. For whatever reason, the Prime Minister's now picked it up and that's being driven to a conclusion. I haven't asked, but from what I read in the papers, it seems to be very much along the lines of what Alan Hawke proposed, probably more than 2 years ago. So there is delay, significant delay, in the current arrangements, and of course that contributes to cost and levels of frustration, and it wouldn't be too hard to deal with. But the more general proposition if we're both thinking of the same thing, is frankly a highly dubious proposition, given the size of the sample and who was responding. And that those people not allowing for sufficient recognition of the impact of the much higher terms of trade and the exchange rate.
I don't think there's a revolutionary solution to the issue, but if you think about infrastructure planning and delivery, it's not just two levels, it's three levels of government. And it seems to me that it's not beyond the wit of man and woman to essentially identify a trajectory at the outset for major infrastructure delivery that essentially is a pathway that a developer has to meet and essentially follow that through. That's very different to the sort of processes that we have now, where it's a hit and miss process, where you may have to go to a local government level. There are options at the state level about whether discretion is used, and then in the environmental space there is, as Terry said, there's the EPBC Act. And whilst the sort of proposal that the federal government has now adopted is a good move forward, it does seem to me that particularly in critical infrastructure, there ought to be a single blueprint, regardless of the level of government, which is laid out at the front end, and then a requirement that each of those steps are complied with and done in a proper sequential form.
Okay. So that's working now, Aaron? Okay, so the gentleman there.
I just wanted to take the conversation on the media context in a slightly different direction, particularly thinking about challenges for the public service at all levels of government. How good a job is the Australian and Victorian public service doing in taking the opportunities of the new media environment to engage citizens on the detail and the opportunities of reform or service delivery innovation? I realise we've talked a bit about the difficulties that politicians and political commentators have in nurturing a detailed and information-rich discourse. Could the public service be doing a better job in providing that information and enabling those conversations?
It could, but that comment would be subject to what I said before about what departments do and what do agencies do. I think people in departments are the ones that have the closest relationship with ministers, are providing advice, are involved in decision-making, and it would be pretty difficult for them to be out there taking advantage of the new social media. On the other hand, people in delivery agencies or running service delivery institutions at the local level to an extent already do get involved and could get further involved. The Commonwealth changed its guidelines 3 years ago, perhaps, governing what Commonwealth public servants can say in blogs and so forth. And there was some guy who started a blog anonymously and was a bit out there in his comments, and the whole roof nearly fell in across government. And he happened to work in an agency that sort of was hanging off my department at the time, so I got a bit involved. What does that tell you? Well, it tells you that I think public servants would get into it more than they do. But the single-minded desire of people at the political level to micromanage what goes to the media anywhere, anytime, doesn't allow much space for public servants to be involved, particularly those anywhere near ministers in a Department of State.
I'm generally a cup half full person rather than a cup half empty person, so let me try and sort of do it in that context. We have seen, what we're seeing is continually newly emerging forms of social media opportunities, and I think in the nature of the public service, but more generally, I think there's a gradual build-up of people seeing what the opportunities are in the context of a tendency towards both inertia and conservatism, and some of it for good reason. So, I can point to a whole lot of examples, both at the Commonwealth level and at the state level, where these new forms of media are being used. And I think over time we will see them being used much more, not so much in a sense the comments that Terry was making about the way public servants might themselves engage in that space, but in the broader policy development space. But I have to say there's a real unease at the political level of actually using these tools. Apart from some people getting encouraged by Twitter, I mean, the actual use of social media for getting an understanding of what people think or providing people with channels or opportunities to input into policy development, even protecting, the traditional confidentiality that's needed in the policy development space and then the political decisions that are made, there is a real timidity at the political end for doing this. So I think yes, there are a lot of opportunities. It will take time. It's probably not the worst thing in the world that it does take time, because people will then, in a sense, get a measure of the risks. But I think there's certainly the sort of cultural environment that we see here is quite different, and you can sometimes contrast that in the United States, where there seems to be a much more open discourse and a use of new technology for, developing not just input into policy to the extent that they make national policy, but also in terms of service delivery. And we put our toe in the water fairly cautiously.
Yeah, so let me be very clear. I think there should be much more of it by people in service delivery institutions, relatively self-standing agencies, where people in those circumstances should be more apparent in the media talking about the business of their agency and the issues that it's facing. They should also be able to do more market research to see what their customers think about what they're doing. There is a fair amount of that done already. So look at public hospitals in this state, for example, just as one example. But I'm pretty cautious when it comes to departments, which in terms of what I said before, would be smaller and more specialised than they are at the moment if more of their activities were decanted out into standalone agencies with the specialist skills, or along the lines, and Yudi and I agree on this, of the programmatic confetti being swept away, a lot of those activities just being got rid of.
Let me give you a conundrum that you always have to deal with, and that's in the context of freedom of information. Freedom of information, whatever the difficulties there are in terms of the way it's currently used, is a very important tool in a representative democracy. Departments going out and seeking views of how well things are going in terms of their particular programmatic activities, or views about how well the department delivers its services, results in a product that invariably is available under freedom of information. Now, when you think about the challenges of that in the context of the tabloid type media that I was talking about, then you get an understanding of the risks that are involved in seemingly very straightforward attempts at understanding how well you're doing.
Could I just make one final comment? One of the things I do now is chair a New South Wales government authority called the Barangaroo Authority, which is responsible for a $6 billion development to the west of the Sydney Harbour Bridge on 22 hectares, the old Patrick's Wharves in Sydney. And there was a big review of Barangaroo before I got there, and I decided to break with the habits of a lifetime and encourage people in the authority to put more information on the web. And that started to happen, but interestingly, nobody's noticed. And that includes minutes of the authority's board meetings. It includes performance information. So I don't know what's going on, because this used to be an extremely controversial development. Are there any journalists here tonight? I shouldn't be saying this, I suppose. That's off the record. So it's really a comment on what Yehudi said. If you can find circumstances where you put stuff out and a few people go after it, but nobody really gets onto it.
Oh, I'd agree. My view about these things is I'd put everything out. By default, I would put as much data out as possible. That's the critical issue.
People who want to come in, and we're running out of time. So I did say I'd come to you next.
Thank you, Mr. Moran and Mr. Blanchard. You covered a broad range of really huge challenges and highly complex ones. My name is Xu Ling. I'm a student at this university. Probably don't read the newspaper as much as I would like to. As a young person who's just about to finish uni and enter the workforce, I'm particularly keen on beginning a career of the Australian Public Service. So my question would be, what would your advice be to the future public servants or someone in my position that's hoping to join the public service? Thanks.
Well, it's terrific that you would be interested in joining the public service, and in the Premier's department here and in the Prime Minister's department in Canberra, we tended to take a bit of care with marketing opportunities for people coming out of universities, and we got fabulous young people applying. I mean, astonishingly good, such that I thought that if I were a young person now, I wouldn't get employed in my own department because of the... I did years ago, but the standard these days is much higher, and the number of applications is enormous. I think we used to get in the Prime Minister's department something like 800 or 1,000 applications for 30 positions of people coming out of university. So the point is not saying that it's hard or competitive, but there are a lot of people like you who are talented and really want to get into the public service. The trick for the leadership of the public service is to solve the conundrum of why quite a lot of people leave after about 5 years plus. But then it was always the case that quite a few people left. It may be just rather more are doing it now. My own daughter left university and joined a Commonwealth government agency, and I encouraged her to do that, saying that if she did 4 or 5 years there, she'd get some wonderful training and great experience, which she did. She then did some more study and went out to the private sector and did very well there. I don't know whether she regrets her time in the public service. I hope that she doesn't. But possibly she'll go back again later in her career. So the second point I'm making is that a person like me who spends most of their working life in the public service is going to be less common in the future. But it's much easier now than it was when I started out to get in at an executive level at any one of a number of levels. So you can go out, come back in, and I think in the future that's more going to be the story of how the public services get good people.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, working in the public service is immensely interesting. The variety of opportunities that you get and the jobs that are embedded within all the various departments and agencies are both intellectually interesting and also carry with them a sense of public good. It's very competitive to get in. Terry mentioned PM&C in Victoria. We have a graduate recruitment scheme. Last year, I think there were about 2,500 applicants for 100 positions. And I'm absolutely sure, I actually got into the public service many years ago through the graduate recruitment scheme, although I didn't take up the position. Had I been applying now, there is no way I would get in. I mean, the quality of applicants is great. And I think the challenge is not so much about people coming in and out, because I think that's probably a good thing. It's really the challenge for management is ensuring, like in any organisation, that people have positive experiences and opportunities, and particularly the young ones. And I think increasingly in Victoria, we're seeing, certainly for those who come in through the graduate recruitment scheme, we're seeing that happen. But like any employer, government agencies, some are better at it and some are worse at it. But that said, I would certainly say, I mean, I spent my whole career in the public services, Terry did. I had an enormous variety of opportunities and enjoyed every bit of it.
So really interesting work, working with really talented people and hopefully working for talented people. It can be very attractive in those early stages of a career.
But not as good as being lucky.
Yes, Professor.
I just want to make a few closing remarks before we move out into the reception. I mean, I think first thing that this presentation and Yehudi's discussion has done is to remind us of the richness of history and the fact that perhaps there aren't too many new ideas. The story that both Terry and Yehudi told us is one of invention and reinvention, but often of good ideas sticking and maybe being revised rather than revolutionised. There's also been implicit and on occasion explicit in Terry's presentation reference to the limits of government and to the fact that we all need to come to terms with the fact that governments have limits and that we as members of the public need to both acknowledge that but also to work with governments to remind them of what we think the priorities really are, but also to understand that there are some things that governments both can't and indeed shouldn't do. We may disagree about what that is, but it's a conversation worth having. This leads me on to the issue about citizen-centric government, which we've talked about here in a number of ways, and I think Yehudi's challenge about the extent to which local government is either a viable or valid institution in the face of a myriad of other opportunities available for delivering services, responding to citizens at the very local level, is a really important one. But whatever the solution, managing the tension between governments at all levels that express a desire for being citizen-centric and them actually able to do that, I think is a very difficult tension that we haven't yet got right, but is a very important tension to manage. And lastly, I think this conversation about the media, which I was expecting to come up, is a really important one, both because it brings into sharp relief perhaps the limits of print and indeed social media. Because one of the things Mark Davis, a colleague here at the University of Melbourne, pointed out very nicely, I think, yesterday in an opinion piece, is that social media is all very well, but it tends to speak to people who are already converted to that particular point of view. And that leads me to my closing point, which is that really if public debate is to be fostered and to prosper and to be genuinely about bringing people together from different perspectives and different positions, then universities are both an excellent space to do that, but also have a responsibility, I think, to take that on and to provide that space if that space is not going to be available or as available as it was in traditional media. So that's a challenge for us, and it's one that I think we are happy to take on. But for now, I'd like you to put your hands together and thank both Terry and Yehudi for a very stimulating discussion.